This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Xiaoyik. Today, we're talking about childhood obesity. And when we talk about obesity, of course, we look a lot at the prevalence among adults. But are we doing enough to address it from the point of childhood? Because that's when a lot of habits are being formed. That's when your growth is being determined as well. So on today's show, we'll be discussing the consequences of childhood obesity, as well as how we can better manage and prevent it among children. In the studio with me, Associate Professor Dr. Mohamed Yazid Jalaluddin, consultant pediatric endocrinologist from University of Malaya Medical Center, as well as Dr. Yang YY, clinical child psychologist and senior lecturer at University Kebangsaan Malaysia. Good afternoon. How are you both today?
Oh, we're great. Thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
Not at all. You're most welcome. Let's start with the basics, actually, understanding what obesity in a child actually means. Perhaps, Dr. Yazid, you could help us define it.
Okay. When we talk about obesity in children, we basically need to look at their body mass index. And body mass index in children differ between gender and differ between ages. So it's not one number that define them to be obese. Because of that, we need to have a proper chart. And as Malaysia, we do not have our own growth chart or our own BMI chart. Mm-hmm. We depend mostly on the World Health Organization chart. So based on those charts, we then define a child to be overweight when they are above the 85th percentile. And if they are above the 95th percentile, they are then called as obese.
And this is something that when parents bring the kids to see a pediatrician, you know, you measure their height, their weight, and then you plot on the chart.
Yes, that's correct. But unfortunately, not every doctors do that. Not every doctors actually plot the BMI on the chart, and parents being informed about the BMI of the child.
I mean, I know for sure it's something parents do much more conscientiously during perhaps the first 2 years of a child's life. But after that, also, you don't tend to bring your child unless your child is sick, and then the child is treated for perhaps an infection. So are you saying that it should be regular practice?
Exactly. Yeah, that's what my point is. Because in the first 2 years of life, all of them will get their immunization, at least up to the age of 1.5. And they have a regular follow-up at either the maternal and child health clinic in public hospital, public clinic, or even at the private clinics. So all these are well measured. But beyond the age of 1.5 years, we do not actually have a regulation to say that parents must bring their child at least once a year to have their height and their weight measured and look at their BMI. As such, this group of patients, this group of children between the age of 2 to 5 or even 6, never been measured, never been plotted. Only when they get into kindergarten or even in primary year 1, by the age of 7, that all these are being redo and relook. And you have all the measurements. And by then, to me, it's a bit too late where you should be able to enforce certain things when they are still young. Because when you need to do any corrections or any improvement in their behavior, it's best done when they are still very young.
Dr. Yang, in our culture, what do you think? Do parents think of obesity being a problem for children, you know, at that age, below the age of 7? Is it something that is that we consciously think about?
I think at this moment in time, most families still enjoy looking at chubby kids as being cute and healthy, as a sign of, oh, they're doing well. So culturally, if you look across the different ethnicity, it's the same. What kind of children would be described as being healthy? It's the one that actually have a full face, the ones that toddle around.
So then, would you say that it is right from infancy that we should already have in mind that obesity could be a medical problem?
Yes, it is. I think when we talk about obesity, we actually need to start off with the parents themselves. it has been shown that in Malaysia, those adults between the age of 30 to 35 and between 35 to 40, about 55 to 60% of the women are already overweight or obese. So there is a study to show that if either parent, one of them is either overweight or obese, there's a 4 times risk that the child will be either overweight or obese. And if both parents have problem with obesity, there's 13 times risk of the child to be either overweight or obese. And just by looking at that point of view itself, we have to be very careful when we actually advise in terms of the growth of the child, right? Because as Dr. Yang mentioned just now, we tend to be very happy to see the child is chubby and full of fat. Even it becomes like a norm now that if the child is normal, they tend to be kind of like being looked at as not normal.
As under
underweight. Something like that.
Because, okay, so even though, even though the child's weight or BMI is actually normal, because they're not chubby, then they're not seen as healthy. So-called healthy.
Exactly, yeah. That's, that's some perception that we need to change as well among the parents. And this is basically being seen across all ethnicities, as mentioned. And again, in the first 2 years of life, in order for us to avoid childhood obesity, we enforce on breastfeeding. And breastfeeding in the first 6 months of life has been shown to actually reduce the risk of overweight obesity in children. And I think what Malaysia has done so far under our maternal child health documentation that we have until 2016, that the rate of breastfeeding has gone up nicely from just 30% to now about 53% up to 6 months. And that is something that we should continue to enforce to make sure that they are all breastfeeding well. Beyond breastfeeding is the complementary food. That's where a lot of parents do not really have a good grasp on it. So basically, it's all about just feed them everything and everything gets in and huge calorie. That may then push them towards the obesity. And again, studies have shown that if you were to be overweight, obese in the first 2 years of life, that's a risk that you continue to be overweight, obese as an adult. So again, as I said, the first 2 years of life is so important that we need to do all those changes before we even talk about try to change the diet of a 7-year-old or a 10-year-old.
But okay, that's actually really alarming because the 2 year window is such a small window. Does that mean it's too late for parents of, say, primary age or teenage children to start changing habits?
It's not to say too late, but it's probably a little bit more difficult. You need to put a little bit more effort to cut down, to improve the obesity. Because it has been shown, again, from research, those children who are between 5, 6, 7 years old, if they are to be obese, there's a 30 to 40% chance that this group can continue to be overweight, obese as an adult. That means about 50 to 60% of them you can change. But you have to put more effort on it. But if you're an adolescent, if you are obese or overweight during adolescence, 70 to 80% chance that you're going to continue to become overweight, obese adult. So 20 to 30% can still change. But as we all know, to change, to reduce weight is not easy. It has to have a constant effort. And as you grow older, more effort needs to be put in.
So that's why we are looking at as early as possible.
Yeah, and I think sometimes parents are very anxious when they don't see their child eating. So there's also a cultural element where they have to finish feeding the child rather than reading the child's cue. You know, the child might say that, oh, I have enough, you know, I would like to stop. But parents felt that unless the bowl is cleaned out, I haven't done my job.
And
this would apply to not just parents, grandparents, or even sometimes the maid. So you really have to tackle this across the board.
It is a unique perception or practice in our culture, you know. There are children starving in Africa is a common thing that, you know, when I was growing up, you know, we heard our parents say it.
Finish it off.
That's right. Every single last grain of rice.
Yes. Yeah, but again, the thing is that what I can see from there may be true before when we have to finish the whole bowl and we spend 2-3 hours outside of the house and play.
Yes.
And just, you know, burn all the things. Yeah. But nowadays, they have to finish the same amount of rice or whatever food in that same size of bowl. But after that, they just sit on and moving their
gadgets.
Fingers.
Gadgets. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so very minimal physical activity that also may contribute to that overweight and obesity. Mm. So these are the things that is not congruent, it's not consistent with what the intake and the output is. Yeah. So,
I think, Prof. Yazid, if you talk about the content of the bowl, I think nowadays the menu that goes in that is available for our kids are very different from what we had.
Exactly.
It's always sort of like party food, or you have very luxurious things that we have it once a year perhaps, but you can have it daily now. Rendang is something that is available most of the time, all kind of curries and things. Mm-hmm. I think that actually changes the food selection.
Those
or
with
availability.
The high calorie.
Yes.
Yeah, those with high calorie. Mm-hmm. I mean, even though you probably see it's the same amount, but the calorie content is different.
Mm.
So because of that high calorie and lack of burn calorie.
Yes.
So you just continue to put on.
But there's the psyche of parents today as well, because I have more disposable income, probably.
Yeah.
I have much better access these days to different kinds of food choices, much more abundant food choices. And parents today, we have fewer children. We want to give them the best.
Everything.
Which more, but more isn't always better.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we're talking about childhood obesity today with Associate Professor Dr. Mohammad Yazid Jalaluddin, Consultant Pediatric Endocrinologist from University Malaya Medical Centre, and Dr. Yang YY, Clinical Child Psychologist and Senior Lecturer at University Kebangsaan Malaysia. We've talked about, you know, the two-year window from birth to the age of two being that crucial window when we really need to be addressing a child's weight and looking at preventing obesity right from that point. But Dr. Yazid, you've already mentioned consequences in adulthood very briefly. So when we come back, I want to go more into that so that we really understand the consequences of being obese as a child. We'll be right back on BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Xiao Yik. In the studio with me, Associate Professor Dr. Mohammad Yazid Jalaluddin, Consultant Pediatric Endocrinologist from University Malaya Medical Centre, along with Dr. Yang YY, Clinical Child Psychologist and Senior Lecturer at University Kebangsaan Malaysia. Today, we're discussing childhood obesity. We're looking at health impact. We're looking at habits as well, because that's a big part of what contributes to a child being obese. Dr. Yazid, earlier you've already mentioned, you know, depending on a child's age, their risk of becoming an obese adult is sort of already set if they are obese at that point. So between the ages of 5 and 7, if a child is obese, they have a 30-40% chance of becoming an obese adult. Adolescents, if they are still obese at that point, the risk goes up to 70-80%. What are the other health consequences that continue on into adulthood that we need to be aware of?
Okay, before we move on to the adult health consequences, I would probably want to just talk a little bit on the health consequences
as a child as well. That's right. Yeah,
because when we talk about obesity in children, we have to look at the short-term health problems and the long-term health problems. Mm-hmm. When we talked about the short-term health problems in children, we talk about mainly the two different group. One is the medical consequences. Mm-hmm. Two is the school consequences.
Mm-hmm.
When we talk to parents about medical consequences, sometimes they don't see it. But when we talk about the school consequences, the academic part of it, then they will start to open their eyes.
Okay.
Yeah, the reason why I like to talk about the school or the academic consequences is that when a child is obese, they may have problem with sleep. in a very obese child, they may have problem with obstructive sleep apnea. Yeah. We call it OSA. And when you have these kind of issues, the next morning you'll be very sleepy. Mm-hmm. So you can be sleeping in a class, you're not concentrating, your academic can reduce. And that is really a problem mm-hmm. in obese children. And in this group of children, they may be left behind. Mm-hmm. They may have some issues with their self-esteem as well. Mm-hmm. And they may even go into depression. Mm-hmm. If those things has been like talked about every day, mm-hmm. they may go into that area. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But when we talk about the health consequences, I mean, being obese itself, yes, there's a risk of type 2 diabetes mm-hmm. in this group of children. I mean, in my care at the University of Malaya Medical Center, we started obesity clinic for children since 2006. So we have like 15 years of follow-up of children. And yes, in the long term, we may see them to have type 2 diabetes, but I'm already seeing them when they are in their early teens.
Early teens.
If they are obese at a very young, even before 5 years old, when they are in their early teens, they are already developed type 2 diabetes. So you do not need to wait until they are 20 or 30 years old to develop type 2 diabetes. Not just type 2 diabetes, they may have issues with their cholesterol. They may have all this hypercholesterolemia. They may also have metabolic syndrome. They may have hypertension. So all this can be there as young as when they are in teens. You don't have to wait when they are until they are 20. Other than that, I'm also seeing some of them with non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. So we have published a few papers from our group about the fatty liver disease in children with obesity. And it's something that is very important for us to look at. We all know in adult, there is this problem of hepatocellular carcinoma. And it's mainly related to hepatitis B. And hepatitis B vaccine has been there from 1980. But yet, we are still seeing that hepatocellular carcinoma increasing in trend. And why is this so? This is mainly related to the issues of this non-alcoholic fatty liver disease in a very early age, develop into cirrhosis, develop into hepatocellular carcinoma when they are about 40, 50 years old. So there's a consequences to what is happening in childhood into adulthood. So as an adult, if they already develop type 2 now, they will continue to have that type 2 diabetes with all the complications. Kidney, eyes, you need to go for dialysis, there may be some amputations going on. So there's a lot of issues when it comes to diabetes itself. And as I said, fatty liver, you develop cirrhosis and you have cancer when you're about 40, 50 years old. To me, this is still a productive group. They should be giving to the country rather than the country is giving to them to cover for their health issues. So there's a lot of issues when we talk about health consequences in obesity. And and I don't think Malaysia wants to go towards that kind of path.
Absolutely. I mean, we are already becoming an aging society with issues that an elderly population is dealing with. Then you have a young generation who can't be productive. I mean, to make is it possible to make a direct correlation between childhood obesity and basically shortened lifespan?
There is a possibility because of all these consequences. Yes.
Dr. Yang, let's continue with that thread that Dr. Yazid had already mentioned about affecting self-esteem. You know, in terms of mental health and well-being, the social, the emotional aspect of obesity in a child, what are you seeing?
Okay, so usually the very young children, because the family treats them well, so they are kind of protected in that way from the bullying that they would later on experience when they come into school. So a lot of the low self-esteem that we do actually see in our cases are actually school-going children, school-age children. So this could be in comparison in terms of the activities that they can do or cannot do, the dressing, the type of things that they can wear and cannot wear. And this comparison could be through social media. So it doesn't actually have to be something that have happened, but what they see going on in other people's life. So we do actually pick this up a lot from the kids that we work with.
Mm.
Yeah. And this is sometimes not the reason why they present to us. They might present to us for other reasons. And then we find that, why are you struggling? Why is it so difficult for you to actually make friends? And then you look at all these other things that is happening in their life and you find that, oh, okay, so there's actually this as a precipitator. Mm-hmm. This is actually predisposing you to actually higher risk of being bullied by others.
Yeah. And what are the long-term consequences of that? It doesn't end when they leave school, right?
Oh, before they leave school, we have had kids who actually wants to change school because they just couldn't actually cope with the kind of pressure and comparison. And sometimes some people feel that it's helpful. They make those kind of comparison not as a way to bully, but to motivate. These are the kind of words that we've heard that, oh, we're just trying to motivate them to actually lose some weight. But it does actually have a impact on these kids, because that's what Prof. Aziz said just now, because it's so much more difficult for them to actually lose those weight.
Mm.
And it's something that they have actually sort of carried with them, which they might thought is all good before this. So why am I now being punished for something that I had no choice in? And I think early on when we talk about how young children's eating habits are all actually influenced by their families, if you have started with very sweet taste, for example, you would have very high tolerance to sweet food. And therefore, you would actually crave for this kind of sweet food.
Mm.
And that would actually be what you would seek, whether you're at home or when you're in school. And although school canteens now actually try to provide healthier options, you cannot stop what's going on
in the family.
In the family or outside of the school.
Yeah.
Those things are still happening.
Yeah. I mean, is that 2-year window also the time when those taste buds are formed and set, you know, those kinds of habits become, you know, almost quite set in a child's behavior?
If you're looking at the 2 years habit, I think you'll be looking at milk. And yes, breastfeeding is the number one choice. And sometimes parents talk about, oh, milk is good. Then they would actually give extra milk. And there are actually sweeter milk in the market.
Yeah.
There's so many options out there. But when you talk about the first 2 years, I would like to bring your attention to actually the subsequent 2 to 4 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's also a time period where we talk about picky eaters.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's actually common in young children to be picky eaters.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much that they won't eat, but they would like to choose food that they like. But because parents are worried that their children are not eating enough, they tend to give in and provide food that the child would actually finish, then you see this cycle actually developing where the children would tend to crave more and more those kind of food that they enjoy, things that are fried, things that are crunchy, you get the whole list of things.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where when parents, especially those working parents, have very little time to actually prepare food or to actually battle it out with the kids sometimes.
Yes.
That's what they say.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're just too tired and lack of energy to actually do the firm parenting that is required.
Yeah, yeah. I'm familiar with that struggle as well. Yeah.
Which we understand.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not easy.
Yes.
So sometimes when we look at the children's intake, we also look at it as in like, you know, what does the child eat throughout the day rather than in that one meal? Because sometimes parents worried about that one meal, but they forget that, well, your child is actually eating
enough
It ties into first that cultural idea of a child must finish everything on the plate, and then in this age 2 to 4 when they're still learning different about different kinds of foods. I know that my experience was that there would be phases where the child would fixate on, I like these types of foods. And you're right. I guess then the parenting strategies.
Yes. I mean, it's okay to have favorite food. I mean, all of us as adults also have favorite food. But you know the danger of just having the same kind of food again and again.
Mm.
There are actually studies that show in order to introduce a child to a new food, you have to try up to about 18, 19 times before you can say that the child is really don't want to eat this.
Exactly.
Yeah, but not at the same sitting.
Yes.
Yeah, just at different times.
No, not at the same sitting.
Yeah.
Um, So we've talked about medical consequences. We've talked about the non-medical aspects, I guess, affecting school, academic performance, self-esteem as well. Let's look at interventions.
Yeah.
From your perspective, Dr. Yazid, I'll get to Dr. Yang later, but from your perspective, how do you look at obesity from an interventional perspective?
Okay. I think there are a few things that we need to look at before we even do the intervention. We need to look at the risks. Why do they actually become obese? When we look at risks, we want to look at a different perspective. Either this is too much of intake or too little of calorie
output.
Burn.
Mm.
Yeah. Mm. So too much of intake could be because of the fact that they are taking too much at certain period of time. And we know among adolescents, 70% of them take a very high supper.
Mm.
So very high supper is not good for you, mm-hmm. because after you take the supper, you go to sleep and everything is kept.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that calories should not be there.
Mm-hmm.
Then we also know about another 7 out of 10 adolescents skip breakfast. Mm. Skipping breakfast is not good because skipping breakfast make you have hunger pangs.
Mm-hmm.
You tend to eat more later during the day.
Mm-hmm.
And that again, we have to look into so that we can change their way of taking food to start off for a day.
Yep.
And I think it's not that easy to do in Malaysia, not just in adolescent group, but also in the primary school, because our school starts very early.
That's right.
Our school starts very early by 7:30, and not many children has so-called the appetite to eat or even to take a glass of milk before they go to school.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, a lot of them skip breakfast. And we know you should eat breakfast like a king, but a lot of our children do not do that.
Mm.
The next thing that we have to look at is also the sugary drinks.
Mm-hmm.
We did a study in schools among the adolescents, and we have shown that for those children who are taking more sugar-sweetened beverage, even though they do not develop diabetes, they already show some degree of increase in triglyceride level in their blood as compared to those with the lower sugar intake. And I think we have to look into that very seriously, because in the school, there should not be any colored drinks.
Mm-hmm.
School should just prepare or just give free plain water.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, your water cooler and all those things should always be there, ready, so that these children can actually take at any time, rather than needing them to go and buy from the canteen.
Mm.
And as you see, a number of coloured drinks are all there.
Yes.
Yeah. So I know under the Ministry of Health, under the Nutrition Group, we have kind of like banned the carbonated drink machines and all those other machines that...
The vending machines.
Yeah, the vending machines.
Mm-hmm.
But there are still some who actually say that they are providing juices and all that thing. But again, all these juices are...
Full of sugar.
Again, full of sugar.
And very little fruit.
Exactly. So as I always tell my patients, the fruits are being made for you to eat, not for you to drink.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because you need the fiber
to
make sure that you get the taste and you also cut down in the sugar rush after you take the juices, right? So a lot of things that we need to really look at a different group of children. I mean, at the primary school, in the secondary school. And here I would like to just introduce what we have done nationally under the My BFF at School, which is, actually the full name is My Body is Fit and Fabulous.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
It's a BFF, Best Friend Forever, so we changed it, BFF to Fit and Fabulous.
Mm-hmm.
So this is basically the intervention that we do for the overweight and obese primary school children and also secondary school children, whereby we have three different intervention programs. One program is on the food. We teach them that they need to drink water rather than all these colored drinks, do quite a number of knowledge transfer, being able to understand and change a little bit on their attitude, and hopefully they will change their practice, not just in school, but also at home. We also have psychology group because we understand about the issues of self-esteem and depression, even in this group of children. So we have a psychology group looking into this population. And the third thing that includes that is there in that intervention is looking at increasing their physical activity. Quite a number of time that these children refuse to play with other friends of a different size because they couldn't get the ball. They are not fast enough. They are not seen to be part of the team because they are just not so agile, you see. So because of that, we actually, in that intervention, we bring them out. They play together in what we call as small-sided games. So just 5 to 7 people in one group. So they play kind of like football, but over time, we actually increase more different kind of games. So hopefully, I mean, we have shown that there is a good improvement in terms of their body fat percentage, in terms of improving their high-density lipoprotein, which is the good cholesterol. We are now in the kind of like final stage for this intervention to be national, you know, being in the national program. So hopefully in the near future, we will see this kind of intervention in this group of children. As these are basically some intervention in school. So we are, I think we also need to look at the policies because sometimes when you don't have policies, things can't really move.
That's right.
And I'm very happy that Malaysia actually decided to put on that sugar tax in July last year, following some of our ASEAN countries, Brunei, Philippines, Thailand, to name a few, and these are the 50 other countries in the world that put on that sugar tax, mainly for carbonated drinks as well as juices. So I think by increasing the sugar tax, you increase the price of these kind of drinks. So less affordable for certain group to buy, to have this kind of empty calorie. So hopefully things like this can go on and being implemented. Hopefully we can see some reduction in the prevalence of childhood obesity.
And the other one, because you've mentioned the importance of a good breakfast in the morning, the Ministry of Education, well, there was a change. Initially, it was supposed to provide free breakfast for all school, primary schools. Children. Now it's only to underprivileged students in a selected 100 schools. You know, do you think that the government should reconsider it, and it should be universal nationwide to really be able to achieve those health benefits?
Definitely. I think we really need to reconsider on that because we know breakfast is so important and we know these students are already in school very early. And most of the time, they bring with them money. They will choose what kind of food from the canteen. But if you were to have a breakfast that is formalized, that everyone takes it, and all the menu is in control, you know that you're giving a healthy food to everyone. In that way, you are not just trying to help those children who are undernourished under the category of B40, but you are also tackling the other side of the malnutrition, which is the obesity. Mind you, in Malaysia at the moment, we only have 60 to 65% of our children who are in the normal weight category. We have 8 to 10% who are undernourished, but we have another about 20 to 25% who are either overweight or obese. In adolescent, it goes up to about 33%. So we are looking at 1/3 of our population who are in the abnormal weight category, be it undernourished or overnourished. And by having a good breakfast to all, I think we can do something about it.
Okay, all right. We're talking about childhood obesity, together with Associate Professor Dr. Mohamed Yazid Jalaluddin, Consultant Pediatric Endocrinologist from University Malaya Medical Centre, and Dr. Yang YY, Clinical Child Psychologist and Senior Lecturer from University Kebangsaan, Malaysia. We'll go for a quick break, but when we come back, I'd like to ask Dr. Yang about, you know, how she works with children and their parents. How do you take them through? And it's not something you can treat with a pill. Yeah. It's a long process of education and changing of behaviours. So we'll touch on that when we come back, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Xiao Yik. In the studio with me, Dr. Yang YY, Clinical Child Psychologist and Senior Lecturer from University Kebangsaan, Malaysia, and Associate Professor Dr. Mohamed Yazid Jalaluddin, Consultant Pediatric Endocrinologist from University Malaya Medical Centre. Today we're discussing childhood obesity. It's a growing problem in Malaysia. Pardon the pun, but it is a serious problem in Malaysia. We are not just talking about consequences during childhood, but lifelong medical as well as psychological issues. Before the break, Dr. Yazid, you were talking about how we need to be looking at a child's environment and their habits and behaviours. Mm. So, you know, practice like eating a heavy supper, skipping breakfast, the susceptibility to take lots of sugary drinks and foods. The Ministry of Health is already trying to tackle some of that. The sugar tax is meant to address the easy availability or the affordability of sugary drinks. The Ministry of Education is looking at free breakfast to selected students. If that could be implemented for more children, it can have health benefits. What about the, Dr. Yang, the marketing of fast foods and high sugar foods, and how much of an impact does it have on a child's choices and behaviours when these choices are advertised to them?
Yeah, I think when you advertise something, it works when the advertisement is fun, it actually shows enjoyment. So these are what we call sort of like conditioning. So when you actually condition pairing out good stimuli, happy stimuli with the food, you tend to expect having those feelings when you eat them. Mm. So for young children, when they see that, they make that association because they might lack the ability to reason. So that's the danger when you actually have this kind of marketing shown to kids. And I think that's why some countries actually have rules about what kind of advertisement come out during certain time.
I think that Malaysia, we limit advertising during certain hours or certain types of like children's programming.
Yes.
But I noticed that it's sort of free for all on YouTube.
Yes.
And a lot of children are accessing, watching things on YouTube. Yeah. What do you think we can do there? It's a tough question.
Yeah.
Does it come back to then the onus being on parents?
Yeah. I think there are two things here.
Yeah.
Parents need to look into that. They have to give limits when it comes to surfing the YouTube, especially for the young children. But I guess the country also has something that we can do. I know when we talk about policy, there is a policy of not having all this advertisement. And actually, under certain group, certain ministerial, you can actually limit the advertisement, even in the social media. So things like that should be implemented. And I know it's not easy because all this gives money, the financial aid to the country. But I think we have to have some balance in that.
So I guess in that sense, when we talk about this association and pairing, it's also very important that we show other things associated to activities and to food independent of these fast foods.
For example.
Yeah, so because you might actually see birthday parties now being organised in fast food outlets.
Yes.
And once you have that association, then it becomes just a norm for everyone. So if a class of 25 kindergarteners, they go, then they will actually enjoy the time there, and then they will expect something like that to happen to them.
Mm-hmm.
But if you actually change that practice, either from the school, from the teachers and from parents that, okay, it could be a fun activity. We could actually make our own sandwiches. I remember if you talk about cakes, that's not in our culture when we were growing up. But nowadays, if you have a birthday, you don't even get one. Yeah. Sometimes you get a few cakes from different people. So that's where you come in when you talk about marketing. Is this a need or is this actually a luxury or is this something extra? Mm. So going back to the basics and helping children understand that means that we have to make those practices real.
And I mean, when you work with children who are obese and with their parents, there must be a lot of re-education involved.
Yeah.
In the first place, when you talk to children about obesity, assuming, of course, they're at an age and they're mature enough to understand, how do you introduce that subject to them?
So for young children, usually we don't breach the subject of obesity, trying to help them define it. It's more like, okay, what would you like to achieve? So we work on a positive model of behavioral change, as in like, what would you like to do and what we can do to help you get there? So that doesn't put too much emphasis or kind of labeling and negativity as in, oh, you are obese in that sense. But it's like, you know, there are a lot of things that you might want to enjoy more. You know, you might not enjoy having all the sweatiness when you actually exercise. Why do you think that happened? So, okay, because you are a bit on the heavy side right now. So let's see, is that what the doctors say? So what are the numbers? What can we do about it? So we work together with the child and the family in terms of achieving what would they want to do as well. Because it's not about us setting a target for them, but also about them coming on board and setting their own targets.
Mm.
So you talk about working with children and their family. So young children's food availability and access to food all depend on the adults around them.
Mm-hmm.
So definitely we have to actually work with them. We also understand that sometimes it's quite difficult. We usually work with what motivates them.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, so what would you like to achieve with your child? Because most parents, I think 100% of them would actually tell you that they want their child to be healthy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So we say, okay, so yeah, we would like that too. So what are the things that we can do to achieve that? I think what Dr. Ajib mentioned earlier is that we're not just looking at weight per se. We also look at activities and eating habits. So that's a whole lifestyle modification, which adults also go through.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we actually get parents on board to see what are the things that they can change because children see and observe more than they listen.
Mm.
Yeah, so whatever they see their parents do, they tend to actually repeat or imitate.
Mm. So you're getting the parents to change their behaviours?
Yes, because it's for the good of the family. Yeah.
But it must be more difficult in the adults.
Well, we start with simple achievable ones, goals, what we call the SMART goals.
Yeah. You can't change the child. You need to change the family.
Okay,
you
as a unit.
You cannot do it individually just for the child.
Mm-hmm.
The child should not be taking different food than other family members.
It's not a punishment in that sense.
Okay, that's very good point. Yeah. And also extended family. Grandparents are usually quite influential in decisions for the child. Like you said, domestic helpers as well.
Yeah.
Looking even beyond the family unit, then community, childcare settings. We've talked a bit about school canteens, but if we are talking about those early years, 2 to 6, they're in kindergartens and childcare centres.
Yes.
And you know, it's so tough for parents. How much can we expect of these centres to be able to provide what we deem as being a healthy nutrition for our kids? Yes.
From that point of view, I think we have also tried to work with the KEMAS that takes care of these childhood centres under the public.
Yes.
They actually work very closely with the nutrition group under the Ministry of Health, looking at what kind of menu that they actually prepare for the children who stay with them for that day.
Mm-hmm.
So, in fact, actually, this is already in place. There are people who actually going through all the menu to make sure that they are all good.
Mm.
to make sure that they are not excessive in certain amount, mm-hmm. especially all the sugars and the fat and all that. But I think this can be done. And I hope those in the private side will also to emulate all this rather than, you know, just being done under the certain group, under the government sector.
Mm, yes.
But because we have so many other private
That's right.
kindergartens mm-hmm. that hopefully will emulate this kind of thing so we can cut down in terms of the overweight and obesity yeah. among the more affluent group.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, yeah, affluent, not necessarily as well. I mean, the middle income group yes. is a big one. And we are sort of at the mercy of the centres that we send our children to. Mm-hmm. There's very little control that yeah. we have in those decisions. If we were to sort of come back to policy again, because what we can do at the family level is one thing, and mm-hmm. then policies dictate the environment around us. Are there any innovative strategies that other countries are doing to address childhood obesity that perhaps we can consider looking at?
There are more activities, basically, in terms of the housing area mm-hmm. that even at the moment we are looking into it. I know the country is looking into that any housing area, you must have a playground.
Mm-hmm.
You must have a pavement mm-hmm. that people can run, can jog and all that. Mm-hmm. I think that's a good idea.
Yes.
That this has to be provided. Yeah. There are other countries, like even our very near neighbour, have the program for the whole country.
Mm-hmm.
The more you walk, the more you have your steps, mm-hmm. the healthier you are, the more incentive that you get.
Mm-hmm.
Something like that. Mm-hmm. I think we need to really look at all those successful stories from other countries to put it back to our people
yeah.
that these things can be done. I know that we do see some paper cuttings, you know, some videos on people just take the elevator rather than the stairs, mm-hmm. which is next to the elevator.
Mm-hmm.
And once you put music to it, whenever you step on the stairs, you have some music all and right. all that, then people start walking. So yeah. some creative things like Correct. That can mm. be done.
More interactive yeah. environment.
So yeah. people have more, you know, they like it more mm-hmm. to have something that they can get in return
mm.
rather than just being put to them and you just do this and mm. get it done, you know.
Okay.
Yeah, I think something simple like that.
Yeah. Changing it from chore to fun, yes. having fun, I guess, exactly. is very important, especially with children.
Yeah.
Anything that is fun becomes easy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they don't mind spending the time with that. And I'm not sure if Prof. Yazid have actually heard about this idea that some of the research group is trying to look at. It's actually to have longer break time. Because right now, our recess time is so short that you have our kids actually just gobbling up whatever they have mm-hmm. or rushing through their meal, which actually really defeats the purpose of actually eating. Mindful eating means that you pay attention to what you eat, you chew properly. It allows the body to process that information that you are taking in food, and then you have enough time to let the brain actually pick up the signal that you are actually getting full.
Mm. Yes.
And this is not happening with our children. Mm. So if you look at it, our children are being trained to eat fast and yes. to actually not pay attention to what they're eating since they're young. Every day, whether yeah. it's in childcare or it's in school, all the way up until teenage years and yeah. adolescence and yeah. adulthood, you have a big problem there mm. about how people actually eat and enjoy food.
Mm.
Yeah.
That word of mindful eating mm. is so important
mm.
because,
yeah.
I mean, that's the reason why we also tell parents when we talk to them, don't allow the child to have a screen in front of
yes.
you when you yeah. when you feed them.
That's right.
No TV viewing mm. during feeding because you want them to feel the food,
mm-hmm.
to have the taste, to swallow the food mm-hmm. and feel that something is coming yes. in you rather than all other
stimuli or distraction
mm.
is being distracted.
Yes.
So, right. yeah, I think we need to put back all those things, teach that, our parents. Mm.
But that is a problem and you see it so much now.
You can see them in the restaurants.
Yeah. Mm. That's right.
The screen is in front of them and the child just
Mm.
Yeah.
So again, re-educating parents.
parents, and also I think what they perceive as advantages or helpful. Because sometimes we have had parents who come and explain to us that they are showing an educational program or it's actually a learning program, and therefore they felt that they are actually...
It justifies.
Justify their action, or this is actually trying to help my child be a... better, or, you know, excellent student, perhaps.
Yes.
Yeah. So
I think a lot of emphasis is also being given to academics in school. And because of that, all this timing for recess is very short.
Physical education is
gone when you are during your exam year.
That's right.
It's mainly on tuitions and all that thing. You start school very early, you finish a bit late, then you continue with some more tuition. So The academic emphasis is so much, not just on the child, but on the parents and the school. So the school will tend to use whatever time that they have, putting all the effort towards academic and less to all this behavior,
the
changing in behavior. So there's all this circle of issues that needs to be looked at. It's not just one factor, but it's a whole. It's
looking
whole
at everything in a child's life.
Yeah, because it interlinks. I mean, eating is something that you do at least 3 times a day.
Minimum.
So, yeah, minimum. And therefore, if you don't have the right approach and also attitude towards eating, you are programmed for the rest of your life to treat eating in that way, in a way that you just... forget to actually wait for the signal.
It's a chore. It's something forced upon you, or it's seen as a reward.
And that's
sending the wrong message to children.
That's really right when you talk about reward, that I think Malaysians tend to use food as a reward, either for good behavior or excellence in academics or whatever it is. It is going to be food as a reward.
Even in social settings, the way to have a good time together is to eat together.
And the first thing we ask somebody if you meet them is, have you eaten?
For sure,
Which is okay as long as you eat healthily, I think.
Do you have a final message, Dr. Yang?
I think for our children, it's very important to bring them up in a way of life that they can appreciate eating and also sharing food with other people together with activities rather than just having food for the sake of eating, because we don't eat to live. Oh, sorry. We don't live to eat. We eat to live. Oh, yeah. Look at that. Freudian slip. Yes. So it's very important to remember that, and that children are what they are because of the adults around them. So either directly as parents or carer, or indirectly as what you talk about, advertisers or policymakers, we all have a role to play in how we influence how their life goes on in a day.
Dr. Yazid?
I think parents have to understand that being obese is not something that doesn't affect your health. That's the most important point that the parents need to understand. Yes, you may see that the child is so-called well and healthy now, but what's going inside the body, you would not see unless you check for it. And that's very important because, as I said, you do not need to wait for 20 years to develop diabetes. It can just happen even in the teenage years when you are already overweight, obese at a very early age. Parents do have to be mindful on that. And I hope those parents who have children with that kind of situation, bring them, get the doctor's advice to look into that. And if there is no health issues by now, prevent it further so that it won't even come in future.
Thank you very much. I've been speaking to Associate Professor Dr. Mohamad Yazid Jalaluddin, Consultant Pediatric Endocrinologist from University Malaya Medical Centre, and Dr. Yang YY, Clinical Child Psychologist and Senior Lecturer from University Kebangsaan Malaysia. You've been listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9. The Business Station.